Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and joining us once again in the Cave of Solitude is good friend of the show and fellow podcaster of the Comic Shenanigans podcast, the one, the only, Adam Chapman. How's it going, Adam?
I feel great, and I love that intro. I feel so excited. I feel like I need to, like, run into the room to a screaming crowd.
We're going to have theme music for you next time. Or during this episode, you just tell me what you want, and it'll be like a wrestler intro.
Oh, man. I feel like that would be... I think everything I would pick would be somewhat disappointing in some way, but that's exciting.
All right. Let's get into this episode. I've been looking forward to this one. It was actually, I think, your idea. And I stole
that
it from you.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I stole it from you, but I love it. And I think we should do a sequel for your show so people can, when they want to find the next topic or the next conversation that we have, they just got to go back and forth between the shows. Create all synergy. Right. Okay, so the idea that you had was to do, it's very simple. I've done this with Daf J before, where we take two different things, compare them, and it's called the this or that episode. But in our case, we're going to do it with what do we love more? Collecting comic books and reading comic books, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this or that, we'll go back and forth. Whatever comes to pops in your head as you're looking at your shelf, and we're going to ask or challenge each other to those tough questions, those barbershop questions, as it were, of there's neither really a right or wrong, but it's those ones that tug at your heartstrings. Okay. I got a couple good ones for you.
Ooh, all right.
Okay, so... I'm going to make it really hard right off the top. We're going to do some Frank Miller history here. So okay. If you had to pick, as a comic book aficionado that you are, do you go with Daredevil Born Again or Batman Year One?
Born Again.
That's easy. That was easy for you.
It wasn't hard. Yeah. I mean, I love Year One. Don't get me wrong. But there's so many layers to Born Again that I think it just... I mean, part of it's because you're dealing with a fully, like, the character in the middle of their career as opposed to someone at the beginning, where Year One, it's great. It's stripped down. But again, it's just that. It's very stripped down, very simple. And yet, with Born Again, there's so many layers, so much subtext, so much emotion. And I would say Mazzucchelli's probably better in that. So I got to say Born Again.
Which one came first? I'm always curious about which one he tackled first.
Oof. You know what? I'm off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure it's Born Again.
Like almost back to back, right?
Yeah, I don't think they're that far apart from each other.
Okay. Yeah, I would. I wouldn't know how I would answer that because I think in my core, Batman is like the beginning of comic book love for me in a lot of ways. But when you look at it from when you take a step back and you take in all of the history of comic creativity and storytelling, Born Again is very special. And I think it's when you get to that sophisticated level of reading and understanding it that you really see how special it is. I mean, you don't have to be at that level because it's a great story even just for an entry point, but it has that lasting power.
No, for sure. So I'm going to follow this up then with a natural question, which is, what would you say is, for you, is your favorite between the two stories of Batman Year One and The Dark Knight Returns?
Man, it really depends on the mood, but I'd probably go Dark Knight Returns just because it's, you get the character with a little bit more history to him. So there's all of these what ifs in those storylines, like seeing him and the Joker have that ultimate showdown and seeing him and Superman have that buildup of tension of all that years of history to finally culminate, you get it all there. And I do actually enjoy the Frank Miller artwork in it. But then on the flip side, I love Batman Begins. And when I read Batman Year One, you don't get that movie without all of the things that are established in that book. So that's tough. It really depends on the mood. How about you?
Always Batman Year One. Always. I mean, we're in an interesting generation because, you know, I mean, at least for me, when I first read Dark Knight Returns, it was years into my comic book reading experience. I wasn't reading comics when it first came out in, what, 86, 87? So, like, it wasn't part of my life. It wasn't part of what transformed Batman for me. So I kind of missed I think feeling that part of the zeitgeist. And I remember being around when whatever the Dark Knight Strikes Again came out, and that was not very good. And for me, it was kind of like, well, this is Frank Miller gone crazy. This is him at the natural evolution of his thought processes, et cetera. Whereas Year One just seems so perfect to me. And I don't feel that there's any wasted space. Whereas I can, when I read Dark Knight Returns, it's just, there's some stuff in there that I'm like, ooh, that's Miller starting to lean into what Miller really does later.
Yeah, no, you're right. Certain things age a little bit better than others. And I think the things that are established in Year One, they added layers to the character from the beginning that I think were missing throughout the, like seeing Commissioner Gordon have that sort of imperfection to him adds a really nice touch to the character as he goes along in his story, that arc, instead of him just being there. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. So I'm going to break your mind a little bit then.
Yeah, let's do it.
And tell you that I was looking on ComicBookDB as we speak.
Okay.
And just to kind of have a sense for when some of this stuff was coming out. So on the stands, the same month, or at least the same cover date month, March 1986, you have Batman The Dark Knight number one and the second chapter of Daredevil Born Again.
Wow.
The same month. That's insane.
Yeah, that's... You don't realize how special, like, I was thinking about it by myself on one of those drives to work where I'm thinking about the next road report, and I'm thinking just about Marvel in the 80s and all of the things that are simultaneously coming out or one after the other. Like, what an era of going to a newsstand at the time, because I don't know how many established comic book shops there were, but what an era that was. And to, just with what you said right now, that's mind-blowing. At the same time, Daredevil...
Six months after the final chapter of Born Again is when Year One starts. So again, like, it's pretty tightly together. And actually, at the same time that he's, I guess, writing Year One, you have him also working on Electric Assassin, which is kind of the bridge between Born Again in terms of publication dates. So, like, that's an extremely fertile period. He's doing Born Again, he's doing Dark Knight Returns, then he's doing Electric Assassin, and then he's doing Batman Year One, all in, like, the same year and a half.
And that's following the run that he had on Daredevil all those years.
Oh yeah, like that's crazy. That's not even counting the fact that he had that monumental run that really revolutionized. And like, if he didn't come along and do Daredevil, I don't know if Daredevil's still around. Like, I, honestly, he revolutionized everything about that character. So much of what you read in Daredevil is Frank Miller's, fingerprints all over it. So much of the way we visualize Daredevil or think about Daredevil, the fact that the movies crib from that. Or the movie, I should say, the television series cribs from it. Like, you can't, I can't even imagine Daredevil without Frank Miller.
But see, that's going back to what I was saying before about the 80s, right? Like, a character like Daredevil, which is, we can't imagine it, but at that time, Daredevil and the X-Men are both kind of like there. And then You've got Frank Miller and Claremont, who completely revolutionize how you see these two brands, these two IPs that belong to Marvel that are kind of like just given to these upstarts, and they completely revolutionize everything about the genre of comic books, or the medium, not even the genre, the medium, but yes, the genre of superhero comics. The 80s, like that early, late 70s into the 80s portion, you get the Fantastic Four from Byrne and Walt Simonson Thor. It's so good. So good. That's why I love Marvel. Looking back at that, not when that era, because that was like, I remember those, seeing those books of the ones that I didn't read, but now going back and revisiting them, kind of transporting myself like a kid again, is such a good time.
For sure.
Okay.
What you got next for me?
What do I got next? All right. Okay. Let's keep with the 80s and then a little modern. So let's go with Thor. Walt Simonson Thor or Jason Aaron Thor?
That's a tough one. Honestly, I feel like it's Walt Simonson. I had to think about it for a second, but I think I like a lot of Jason Aaron's Thor, but it also doesn't feel as transformative to the character. Like, he did a lot of cool stuff with it, and obviously with Jane. But it's a different type of storytelling, and I think that there's something even bigger and more grander about how Simonson approached it. And even like the War of the Realms, when it actually happened, felt remarkably small. or smaller than I expected it to in terms of scope. When I think of sprawling war comics done right, Annihilation is always kind of the one that I point to as that's one that felt like a war. Like, even if you throw away the four Annihilation miniseries that led up to the big one, to the main series, if you just read that main series, like, that felt like you had different theaters in a war. Similar, Infinity, which, you know, may or may not have been that important in the grand scheme of Jonathan Hickman's run on Avengers, when Infinity was happening, that felt like a war. It felt like you were seeing different theaters in this war and how it was progressing. So anyways, I always felt that the War of Realms, when it kind of ended, felt like it sputtered a little. Like, it almost felt like he needed a better spot to kind of leave on, and it didn't end up feeling like it paid off the promise.
Mm. Okay, I got you. I mean, it's...
Did you expect that answer?
No, and I think, yes, it doesn't shock me, but if you would have said Jason Aaron, it wouldn't have shocked me either. Because I think those two are the two names that come to mind that have a long association with that character, other than, you know, Stan Lee and Kirby, who mm-hmm. had enough time to really... change the way we view that character. I would say that one of the creative teams that is sorely overlooked is the Friends and DeFalco run on Thor. I think it's severely overrated, in my opinion, even though it becomes a little bit more accessible to a younger, maybe less sophisticated reader than what Simonson's or Jason Aaron's was. But mm-hmm. I do think that they were on that book for so long, and they kept it afloat with really good creative stories that hadn't been done before.
So I'm going to speak some blasphemy here, okay. but I'll frame it in the asking of a this or that question for you. Mm-hmm. So the Simonson run on Thor and the Jason Aaron run on Thor. Mm-hmm. Let's throw away the writing for a minute and say, which one do you think has the best artwork? So one, you have Simonson, and then you have Buscema, and the other one, you have Dowderman, you have Assad Ribic, you have all these other brilliant artists. Which one do you think has the better art?
For me, I would always probably go with Walt Simonson, just okay. because it gives me the full feel of what he was doing with that story. The sci-fi aspect of it, as well as that Norse mythology. I'm a big Simonson fan, so I'll always probably answer Simonson. Not to take anything away from Ribic or Dowderman, because they were perfect for the portions of the story that they were telling. Like, the God Butcher story was incredible with Esad Ribic's artwork to it. But I have a lean. That's part of the reason why I love the Walt Simonson is the art and how he develops those storytelling and the design of Beta Ray Bill and how all the ships work. I when I think of Thor, that's what comes to my mind is Walt Simonson.
I'm gonna go blasphemy, and I think I kind of almost prefer the artwork on Jason Aaron's run. I mean, again, similar in terms of, you know, the length of it, and not to take anything away, obviously, from Simonson, who's brilliant, but there's just something about, I mean, Ribic was great, but I actually preferred Dowderman. I thought everything Dowderman did on Jane Foster Thor, like, to the point where anyone else drawing that character is a pale imitation, and you it's almost like you can't look at it unless he's doing it. And to be honest, and this is part of the modern comics, is that I can't even look at a Dowderman Thor unless you have Matt Wilson on colors. Like, there's just a symbiosis of every element there that has to pop in order for it to work. And the way that that character just jumps off the page because the colors accentuating all the artwork is just incredible. Whereas, again, Simonson, it was the colors of the day. And that's not its fault. And even when you see it reprinted now, they have like a modern recoloring of it, which I actually don't even like. I actually kind of prefer the older colors. So it's just interesting that on an artistic standpoint, partially because of nothing that they could even, it's not their fault, but there's just something special about the eye-popping nature of the current artwork. And again, a little bit of that is unfair, but because you have the amazing Matt Wilson doing colors, like, I can only imagine what it would look like to have Matt Wilson actually like recolor a Simonson Thor. I think I would go to heaven. Like, that would be some of the best art I've ever seen on Thor.
Yeah, probably. And I got to admit, I read the Simonson Thor when the new trades that were recolored were released. That was my introduction. So I don't even have sort of that visual library of what it was originally like. So I'm coming from a not necessarily a fair place myself. But I guess it's how you introduced to it is what it is for you, right?
Yeah. All right, what you got for me?
Okay.
Give me this or that.
Let me see what's a tough one here that could...
Okay. No softballs, eh?
No softballs. It's ones that I... Well, I think... This is the thing. Some of them I think you already have decided in your mind. So it's not even... I think they might be difficult for me, but for you, you probably figured it out already. Okay, how about this one? Avengers Forever or Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Ooh. Whew, that is a good one. I would say Avengers Forever. The reasoning why... So Avengers Forever hits every comic book fan giddy spot that I have, which is complex continuity and making it all work somehow and referencing it like so much and like incredibly an incredible amount of reference and self-referential things towards the past of a certain book or characters. So Avengers Forever has that in like absolute spades. You could argue that the story at times has fits and starts and doesn't always really know where it's going to go, but there's just so much continuity, so much being thrown at you. And when I first read it, I didn't even know all the continuity, so like I was learning all the continuity, and it never felt like it was a chore. It just felt more like exciting, and I think that's what differentiates maybe certain comic book fans or people who get into comics in general, is that you have to love the soap opera. You have to love the decades of continuity, and if you don't, you're probably in the wrong place. It's kind of like turning on a soap opera and be like, "Oh, I don't want to watch this. It's been around for 40 years." Well, if you can't, find it within you to pick it up and then glean the continuity where you can, then you're in the wrong place. So, Avengers Forever is that to me. It really satisfies that need of I have to love continuity and hear more about it. Crisis is absolutely the more influential comic. It's more important, but it creates. It creates continuity in terms of reshaping continuity, but it's not a slave to continuity. It's not really about what came before. Really, it's about constructing what's going to come next. I like both a lot, and I would say, like, the Perez art in Crisis is brilliant, but I got to go Avengers Forever. Like, that's more my jam.
Yeah, I feel you on that one. Because it took me a while to find a proper book to compare Avengers Forever to. I'm thinking, like, what has that sort of scope where you're traversing time and space and kind of the rules are somewhat thrown out, but there's a lot of rules that you're sticking to and establishing in a way. And the only thing I could think of looking at my shelf was Crisis on the other side of the street, as it were, because even it they're dense reads too. Like, it's not something that you just read in a couple of hours. When I remember reading both Crisis and Avengers Forever, it was a meaty read. It was almost like reading novels when you get through them. But I found that reading Crisis for the first time, which was something that it was one of those books I was really building up in my mind because I love George Perez artwork. I'm a fan of Marv Wolfman and the two of them as a team is very storied. And this was, like you said, extremely important for its time. It changed the game. But it seemed a bit more of a chore to read, especially in the little, like, the beginning parts until the story really got rolling and action really started to, like, the Supergirl issue and the Flash issue. Whereas Avengers Forever, I was in right away. Right away, I was invested in what was happening in this story, and I couldn't wait to see where they were going next. And the artwork is, clearly, it's not similar, but it's similar in the way that there's a lot of packed into it. Like, you don't get cheated at all from what the artist is giving you. But I'd say Avengers Forever, too.
Okay. It's interesting. I was, not long ago, I started reading Crisis with my son. So he's six. And, Crisis and Infinite Earths might be a little too heady for him. But I think we got through three or four issues, and then we've been reading other things as well. It was very fascinating to me because I first read Crisis probably when I was in my late teens, maybe early 20s. Like, I knew of it, of course, but I hadn't read it. I hadn't experienced it. So when I read it, it felt like there was a lot going on, definitely of its time in terms of the amount of text and, kind of jumping around with a lot of kind of no-name characters. And I found it a bit of more of a slog when I first started reading it. But reading it with my son and reading it through his eyes was a really eye-opening experience because he didn't have any of that feeling. It was just more like, who's that? Who's that? And this sense of excitement, and it made me think of, well, this is probably what it was like to read this in the 80s. you know, when this was a modern comic, when this was, you know, the big new thing. And we take it for granted because it's this monumental, like, point where everything after it, I mean, for decades, it was, you know, before Crisis and post Crisis, that was just the way you thought of DC continuity. It was this big stopping point. So it was just interesting to be able to read it through his eyes and see what a different, you know, a completely different perspective and different age than I was when I first read it and how he took to the work.
Yeah, I still think of DC like that. I never differentiate anything other than the, you know, 1986 Crisis, even though there's been New 52 and Rebirth and Final Crisis, this, that, and the other. I always see Crisis on Infinite Earths as that relaunch of a whole universe where, because even now, you never go, I don't think we ever go pre-Crisis in any way when it comes to continuity. It's always, that's still the stopping point, even if they want to retcon something.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The only person who cares about stuff that happened pre-Crisis and puts it into his stories is Grant Morrison, because he was of the idea that all these things happened, so yeah, how do I make them work?
Right, and I think one of the few people, maybe not the few, I could be completely wrong, but I think Mark Waid is one of the people who prefer Superman pre-Crisis, but I don't think I would, if I was a comic book reader then, I don't think I would have liked Superman pre-Crisis. I can see why people may have disliked that character.
Yeah, it's interesting too because, I mean, if Mark Waid does have a preference there, he's also told such amazing, you know, post-Crisis stories of Superman. So it's very interesting that he would have that kind of thought. So for this and that question, here's one for you. I think I know what the answer is going to be because there's not a great kind of one for one. Actually, I guess there is. What do you think is a better format? The Marvel Omnibus format, which has been, you know, copied by DC with their own omnibuses as well, or the DC Absolute format?
I don't own an Absolute, so I'd probably answer the Omnibus.
Now, why don't you own an Absolute?
I don't own an Absolute mainly for the way to store it. I don't have the way my shelves are organized. I don't have a proper slot to have that fit in. So that's probably the main reason why I've never gone. I have one Absolute edition, and it's a really random one, and I haven't read it yet, but I do intend to, is Irredeemable.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. I found an Irredeemable Absolute edition. I love Mark Waid. I heard really cool things about that story. I like the pastiche of the Superman character flipped on its side, and I found it for like $24, and it's Absolutes are pretty pricey, so I said if this might be a good place to start, and it's a writer that I know that I enjoy. But when it comes to the other ones, I'm like, which ones would I get? It's usually only like 12 issues. Where do I store it? So that's the reason why I've leaned away from that. But I do enjoy the DC deluxe editions that they put out. Those ones I really like.
Yeah, you know, I like the Absolutes in theory. I agree with you that there's a bit of an issue with storage, but I mean, that's, you kind of expect it. My issue more often than not has been that I feel like the price point is so high for not that much content.
That too.
Usually you don't quite get that many pages, and that's kind of been a major deterrent for me. I think I only own one, I want to say. I might own two, actually. I know I own one for sure, and that was a gift. It was a Absolute Watchman, which is a beautiful one to have.
I was going to say, if I were to own one Absolute, it would probably be the Watchman.
Okay. Well, that was my this or that.
Okay.
Oh, I should say, because sometimes we plug Amazon for some reason, even though they don't need our money. Absolute Flashpoint, not my favorite story, but it's actually currently on Amazon.ca. It's $50 instead of $100.
That's a good deal.
It's a good deal, but again, it's like, you know, not a lot of pages. It's like 270 pages, but, you know, if you really wanted to see, I mean, it has some beautiful artwork. I will give it that. Yeah. It's only $50, so like that's enough to make me consider it.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about that aspect of how much I enjoy that story, because I do like it. I do think it's a good story, but I also have it's one of those, that's right before New 52, right?
That's basically what caused New 52 at first, right? So it's the last gasp.
Yeah.
Another Absolute I just saw, there's the new edition of Absolute Kingdom Come for $85, which again isn't bad. I own it already in trade because I feel like everyone does, but man, it would be nice to have in an oversized format.
That's a good one. I would say the ones that would pique my interest to own would be Kingdom Come, Marvels, and Crisis. Just because mm-hmm. the artwork, it would look great. And Watchmen. Those, I think, are a couple that I would really like to see in that, like, flip those pages in that format. And I'm sure there's others, but those ones, I think, are safe bets that you'll never be disappointed in owning those.
Oh, you know, I think I do have another one. I think I have, I'm pretty sure I have this in my basement. Absolute Batman the Killing Joke.
It's so funny that we're at the point where, like, I think I own that. I think I got that somewhere in the basement, in the storage.
It's sad but true.
Yeah.
What was nice, I'm pretty sure I'm correct on this, because I think the nice thing about the Absolute Batman the Killing Joke is that you have both the original coloring and the recoloring that's been in most trades, so you get to kind of see two very different versions of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, I like anything that gives me an additional reason to need it.
Mm. Yeah.
And actually, I just walked into my basement. Yeah, I do own that. So sad I forgot.
There's a couple of times where I've had that moment. Oh, yeah, I have this. I should put that back on my shelf. That's a pretty good one that I was ready to. There's some books where I'm like, put them aside where I don't want to necessarily see them as that first pick on your shelf. But then I'm like, ooh, that's good to have. Okay.
Man, now we need to read Killing Joke tonight. So thanks for that.
You're welcome. Okay. Is it my turn for another one?
I asked about the Absolutes versus Omnibuses, so it's
okay.
Your go.
Okay. I think this is a tough one. I think. We're going to go with Kurt Busiek.
Okay.
Kurt Busiek, Avengers, or Thunderbolts?
That is a good one. I'm going to say Avengers. I thought I was going to say Thunderbolts. but when I really think about it, as much as I love his Thunderbolts... And let's be honest, like, I enjoy both of them. So this isn't like a one is much worse. Like, they're both amazing. One that just happens to be better. My favorite Thunderbolt stuff, though, is not by him. It's by Nicieza. I think Nicieza is what really made me, like, love Thunderbolts forever, because some of the stories he told were my favorites. So I love Busiek on Thunderbolts, but I think his Avengers is probably a better work. You know, he was telling characters that he always wanted to tell these big, you know, big, huge, amazing adventures with the Avengers. What I loved about it as well, and again, you don't see that anymore in comics, is that, you know, he started Avengers with like basically one issue. It was the first arc was three issues, but really it was almost like one issue that just had the very end was up against Morgan Le Fay, and then you had basically a two-part arc in this other world, and then you had like an issue where they had to figure out the team, and then two issues with Squadron Supreme, and then you had like an issue with I think Live Cree or Die. Like, I loved it was just very, you got full stories in each issue, plus the arcs themselves weren't too long. They didn't overstay their welcome. You felt like he got so much story. So if you look at Busiek's Avengers, like, you have so much going on there. Even his big, whatever his Kang story was, I can't remember the name of it now. Even his Kang story was like multiple levels to that story and so much things going on inside. So as much as I love his Thunderbolts, I got to go with his Avengers.
Yeah, I think his Avengers ages as good as any comic does, even though in the 2000s, as it proceeded and they went into that Bendis era, they kind of, sometimes when you hear or watch videos of them telling you about what Avengers was like before Bendis got on or before Mark Millar did Ultimate Avengers, they kind of crap on whatever was happening in the Avengers a little bit. But I don't think any of those runs will ever surpass what Busiek and Perez did, because it's like you said, it's that sweet spot of having story arcs, but still telling comic book stories in that old classic style without it being aged. It's that perfect sweet spot, I feel, of classic comic books.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So what would your answer be?
My answer would be Avengers. I haven't completed that Thunderbolts run, to be fair, but I know that Avengers run It's special to me because those 25 or so issues of just him and Perez. Is it 25 or did he go up to 32? I think it went higher. I think it went to 35.
I think it was around 30 something.
Yeah, those are some of my favorite comics. And I read those also when I was on like one of my favorite vacations. So it's like that perfect balance of everything being in the right time. So that run will always be one of those series that I always keep.
All right. So here's one for you. And this is a This, That, or That.
Oh, remix.
So in the early 90s, it definitely became a thing that Marvel was doing, that they kept kind of creating spinoffs of their main big characters. So of the three main, like, biggest spinoffs, not counting Ben Reilly, which do you think you prefer in general? John Walker, the U.S. agent, Thunderstrike, or War Machine?
Man, I don't have enough of a connection to either of those ones, but I'm going to go with Thunderstrike because that is the I've been reading Eric Masterson when he does take over as Thor. So I've read right before he becomes Thunderstrike full out. So Eric Masterson is a character who I do have a more of a connection to for sure. How about you?
Okay. It's really tough. I mean, and obviously Rhodes is the one who probably has the most longevity, who survived the 90s more or less intact, whereas John Walker doesn't really show up that much anymore. But I think John Walker to me is actually the most interesting character. Because like Rhodes had been a long standing supporting character in Iron Man, and the way that Masterson had been introduced again was as a supporting character with the idea that they were going to develop him and do other things with him. But there's just something about John Walker's story I really like. I don't know. It's tough. I mean, I know it was my question, but, Thunderstrike is fascinating too, because, this big journey of a hero, and it all ends like with his death. And the fact that they never brought him back, I think, is not disrespect to the character, but I think it's respect to the story that was told. And the fact that we have, his son instead is, again, a further testament to that. I'm going to go with Thunderstrike. I was going to go with John Walker, but you know what? I convinced myself that Thunderstrike was more interesting.
Nice. You can't help but love the Falco and Friends. I know you.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're amazing creators. And, like, again, if you look at the totality of Eric's story, it's both a tragedy and a triumph at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. And I'm surprised. Well, I'm not surprised, but I hope someday that we get more of like the Thunderstrike stuff actually in trade so that people can, re-experience that entire 25 issue run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. This might be a softball. This might be a really stupid question, but I was thinking about it and a little bit of the people's visual library. One doesn't exist without the other person paving the way. But what is your preference? Okay. X-Men art. Let's go into the 90s. We all can think of very specific people that come to mind that everybody loves. I don't think there's a shortage of artists that we like. This is the Pose era. So what are we going to go with if you had to choose? Jim Lee or Andy Kubert?
Okay, so we call it the Pose era. Are we specifically ranking them based on their poseability or just in general, what they are in terms of the art?
Whatever the art, the way you feel for it and how you're connected to those stories. It's just your preference, because I think we all can say that Jim Lee set the standard of things to come after. He changed the game and we all loved his artwork. But then as people took up the reins after him, you can see that there's a certain aesthetic he established that people kind of stick with. Mm-hmm. But then when other people stay on the book a little bit longer, there are moments that are more infamous or memorable that maybe another artist did that Jim Lee didn't do. So what say you?
Oof, that is a much tougher one.
It's not a softball.
No, it's not. Okay. I have to talk to the little kid inside, and I think the little kid inside would say Kubert, but because that was the X-Men that I really like met. Now, I mean, the X-Men animated series obviously made it so that I was meeting the Jim Lee versions, but there's just something so special to the Kubert stuff too. I don't think you, as you said, I don't think you can have Kubert on the X-Men doing it that way without Jim Lee. But I think in a lot of, in some ways he even did it better. And I don't know. And if we're talking about posing, there are so many shots of Kubert's X-Men where they are just looking at something and they're like standing there ready to go. And it's like this pointless pose shot, but I don't care. I love it so much.
That's the thing, right? Is that you look at it and it's like, I love this, even though the storytelling isn't what maybe people did in the Paul Ryan era or whatever the case may be. Is that the right artist? Was it Paul Ryan?
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. So the other day you sent me a screenshot saying that you had picked up the X-Men Skinning of Souls trade paperback.
Yeah.
And like, I look at that, I'm like, oh man, that's some good Kubert stuff in there.
Right, that's the thing. And I'm doing my due diligence with X-Men history lately, I'm going through all of these different era of, you know, watching it transition from Romita to Silvestri, and then you're going through the, you know, Walt Simonson on X Factor, and then you're now going into Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld stories, and you're seeing the style progress to Wills Portacio, and then, like you said, the Andy Kubert, and it's like you see how these characters become redefined in a way, and I remember posters of those Jim Lee X-Men visuals as a kid. But then I confuse them for Kubert sometimes when I look at like Executioner Song, the cover art of that. It's like, that's X-Men to me too. So I thought, which one would it be? Because Kubert is the guy who drew the adamantium coming out of Wolverine, right?
Oh, yeah.
So those are pretty iconic moments. But you know better because you actually read it all and kind of lived through it as a kid. So you're the right guy.
I guess that's true. So my next one, I'll be honest, I'm not sure if you'll even have an answer because it may be too specific, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway.
Okay.
So there's two books that existed in the mid-90s that I would say had a very similar aesthetic from two different companies. And I'm just curious which one you would be most likely to want to read or reread if you've read it before.
Okay.
One is Extreme Justice from DC Comics, which was replacing Justice League International, which had just been canceled at the time. Which is a very infamous book, or Forceworks from Marvel Comics, which is a very similar feel and look. Do you know either of these books?
I know these books. I know that they were both offshoots of specific teams and eras of those teams. I would probably lean towards the Justice, just because I feel like I'd have a little bit more invested in those characters without reading anything about them.
But do you know who's in the team
on Extreme Justice? For some reason I see Martian Manhunter.
Nope. Okay. You wish.
tell me the teams and I'll tell you which one I would read.
All right, so you got Extreme Justice has Captain Atom, Maxima, Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, and Amazing Man. But this is Booster Gold while he's in his armor. And then later on, they were joined by Firestorm, Plastique, and the Wonder Twins.
Okay.
What do you think? What are your initial impressions of that? Does it feel more? Could it feel more 90s than that?
No. And I have more of a automatic connection with some of those characters just because of my reading history. Like, I like Booster and Blue Beetle, but I don't like Booster in the armor. Who's in the Forceworks? I know Iron Man is.
Yeah, so you got Iron Man, you got Sentry, you got Moonraker, Scarlet Witch, Spider-Woman, the Julia Carpenter version, U.S. Agent, War Machine, and very briefly, Wonder Man.
So, Sentry? Which Sentry is that?
This is a Sentry as in how many years there are in 100 years.
I'll read Forceworks.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I'll be honest, they're both kind of a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like it. I don't know. I wouldn't read any. Do I have to pick?
Yeah, you got to pick one of these. Oh, I mean, it's interesting because, again, they're very similar. They're very much like 90s in-your-face attitude. They're both about teams trying to take a proactive stance against, you know, fighting villains, etc. The artwork is very kind of over-the-top 90s and extreme. I mean, the fact that it's actually called Extreme Justice definitely tells you something.
Who wrote them? I think we're giving these books too much attention.
So this is going to blow your mind a little. And this is actually going to make you want to go back and find it. So Forceworks by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning.
Okay. And then Extreme Justice?
Dan Vado.
Forceworks it is.
more of a pedigree, right?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Let's see what I got here for you to rack your brain around. All right. This one, again, might be an easy or difficult one. John Byrne on the X-Men or George Perez on Avengers?
Interesting. John Byrne. Well, you know what? That's so hard. Here's where my mind went. My mind went, huh, John Byrne, amazing X-Men stuff. And then I thought of Perez and Avengers. But for some reason, my mind made a block and said, no, you're only thinking about Perez in the 80s or like late 70s, early 80s. You're not counting his 2000s or 90s stuff.
That's the
and
one.
I'm like, well, yeah. And then I'm like, well, wait a minute. Is that fair?
Right. That's I was actually thinking more about that. I mean, both of his runs on Avengers are very special. But I was thinking more about what he did later that kind of brought the Avengers back, especially from like Heroes Reborn. Because I think when Perez came onto the Avengers were already on a pretty good creative run. Whereas when he did them late 90s, it reestablished them in a way. In the way that the John Byrne did for the X-Men.
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to go with Byrne, though, because I don't think I've ever loved any artwork of Byrne's more than X-Men. I think that, for me, is his peak, which is crazy because it was so long ago. I loved his Fantastic Four, but I don't think it was nearly as special as his X-Men.
Yeah, I agree. It's a tough one because those are two of my, you know, top five artists that I love, but it's hard to argue that run of X, like, I can't think of another duo who have in their run pretty much the top stories of those characters still to this day. Between what Byrne established with Phoenix, the Days of Future Past, Proteus Saga, all of those stuff. Like, it still is, you know, in that top tier of must-read X-Men stories.
Oh, for sure.
Not to say that Perez's Avengers stuff isn't in that ilk. I just think it's, I don't know. I don't think things like Korvac Saga are quite in that stratosphere of Phoenix Saga.
You know what? That's very interesting you say that, because I would say, like, I mean, they weren't quite in the same period, right? In terms of like I feel like the cycle of comic books in terms of the elevation and what you could do in the medium had changed, or what you could do in comics. Whereas I think, like, if you had had the Korvac Saga happening a little bit later, I think it would have been more, or just a little bit different. And part of it's unfair because, you know, Claremont took over a book that was doing nothing and could kind of do anything he wanted. And then when it became a huge success, was still allowed to do whatever he wanted in a way that no one else has ever had that much of a leash, or like lack of a leash, except for maybe Peter David on Hulk, where they could kind of do whatever they wanted and no one really was going to give them any flack.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you make an extremely good point there. Yeah. That's the thing, right? When you look back at some of these runs and you give them all the praise in the world, it's like, well, yeah, Frank Miller was able to do that because he was given carte blanche on Batman to tell the end and the beginning. Like, what would have this guy done with that if he had the opportunity? So it's true. You make a very interesting point. But, I mean, it is what it is at the end of the day, right?
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm going to ask a question. Now, I'm pretty sure I know your answer is going to be already, okay. But I thought I'd at least ask.
Yes.
So of Marvel and DC's kind of premier, buddy groups, what would you put up as kind of your favorite duo? Would it be Blue Beetle and Booster Gold or Luke Cage and Iron Fist?
What do you think my answer would be?
I assumed it would be the Blue and Gold.
Actually, it's the other, Luke Cage and Iron Fist.
Really? I am absolutely shocked.
Why?
I don't know. I just thought a little bit of, like, you were reading DC at a very primo time for the blue and gold team, and a lot of people, like, really love that duo together, and they're a lot of fun. And, you know, obviously Luke Cage and Iron Fist are a pretty big duo as well, but I just thought, given your time period of reading comics, that blue and gold would have been more important to you.
Yeah, you know, you make very valid points, especially because I think the whole value, like, the what really makes Booster and Gold, Booster, Gold, and Blue Beetle, that duo, is what DeMatteis did with them, if I'm not mistaken, which I have a very big soft spot for. So I definitely love those characters, but I just feel like, I don't know. I think Iron Man and Power Man and Iron Fist.
let's get set on their names.
Yeah, I have a, I don't like. I was really, really excited for what possibly happened with the Netflix series, because I just saw so much potential with them. But yeah, I'd probably lean towards that. How about you?
For me, it's blue and gold.
Really? I mean, that's. Yeah. I think it's a completely fair answer, especially what we grew up reading. I don't know. I think I'm undecided. Maybe the last thing that I wanted to read out of the two of them might have been Iron Fist and Power Man. So maybe that's what it is.
I came to Blue and Gold, like, super late. Like, I'm talking, like, early 2000s. And reading their exploits in, like, Justice League, etc. And I just loved it so much. And then seeing what happened, obviously, to Ted Kord in 2004 as part of Countdown to Infinite Crisis, and seeing how their relationship was treated, and then seeing how they interacted in the amazing Booster Gold series by Geoff Johns and Dan Jurgens, when you had Booster Gold going through time and getting to be reunited with Ted. It really made me appreciate and love that relationship in a way that I always liked Power Man and Iron Fist, but I don't know. There was a deeper resonance to me on how Blue and Gold functioned. And maybe the part of that's because one of them died and we actually really got to see what it meant to the other.
Yeah. I guess it's important to see where your entry way is in with those characters. I think when I read the epic collections of Power Man and Iron Fist, it took me by surprise because I knew that it was going to be aged and very much of its time, but I found myself enjoying it and being like, this is actually really good comics for a time when it may have been difficult to get this to work. But yeah, I think it's a toss-up. Again, it's one of those, depends on the day. Good one. That's a good one.
I mean, once in a while, I have a good one, man.
Okay. This one might be difficult for you, but probably not. But we'll see.
Okay.
So this is going to be a female character showdown.
Oh, okay.
Miss Marvel, Kamala Khan, or May Parker, Spider-Girl?
Ooh, that is a good one.
Because I had a hard time with this one myself.
I gotta go I'm gonna go Spider-Girl. I think I loved her first. She came first. I definitely loved her first. I think, you know, here's why I think Spider-Girl, I'm gonna think of it not just as the character, but as the comic they have. And what I love about Spider-Girl's comic was that, you know, it felt like it was so much optimism, and it felt like it was, you know, MC2, but it felt like a universe unto itself, and it felt like there's so much bright, shiny optimism, which you don't usually get in future stories. Miss Marvel is in the, you know, current continuity, but she deals with a lot more heady stuff, and typically. I do love her. I think she's great, and again, so optimistic and a great outlook, and nice to have a very different perspective on things. But I think May is just a little bit more special for me. Though, that being said, I like Ms. Marvel's powers more because they're more imaginative, they're more different. They're not something I've seen in 800 different Spider characters. But overall, just by a hair, I got to give it May Parker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that to be a tough one too, because I think for me, I probably lean towards Ms. Marvel because it surprised me more of how much I love the character. Whereas with Spider-Girl, I already know I'm going to love it. Miss Marvel was much more of like, oh my goodness, this is I love this. And there's a lot of things looking at it when I flip open that book for the first time that the artwork doesn't immediately speak to me as being like my personal favorite, but it becomes something that like the Adrian Alfano art in the first run, I just felt like was perfectly matched with the tone of the character, the power set, the world that she lives in. It's kind of awkward and sometimes unbalanced and can make you feel, you know, not uncomfortable in your skin, but you feel that teenage awkwardness of the character. And I felt like everything in that book was just hitting at the right time. But the Spider-Girl, reading it retroactively, because unlike you, you were reading it as it was happening. So there's a little bit of that nostalgia feel to it. I enjoy it. For sure. I'm enjoying it.
It was exceptionally important to my upbringing in comics.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it, reading it from the perspective of, in my own imagination, like I finished the Clone Saga and now this is what happened if they kept the baby. That's how I read it, and I'm enjoying it with that sort of viewpoint of it all.
All right, so this is like a comics history question. Okay. Who do you think is the – well, I don't know if most influential, but who do you think is your favorite of the maybe top two DC artists who typified the Silver Age of DC comics? Carmine Infantino or Kurt Swan? Those are two big names. Infantino obviously was extremely important. He revolutionized The Flash. But you have Kurt Swan was like the Superman artist, or at least his was the model for Superman in the Silver Age.
I feel like Infantino has his fingerprints on more of the universe, but I probably would go with Swan just because it's one of those first visuals of Superman that I recognized, like that's Superman. Anytime I saw it.
For sure. I would go the same. I think Swan is, there's just something about his artwork, which is just very, this is probably not what they wanted at the time, but it makes me feel comfortable. It's like, you trust this Superman. It just makes you feel good. Like it's like a warm blanket. Like there's just something about his art, which feels very warm and inviting. It doesn't, at the time it wasn't, you know, you had Marvel books that started to get more kind of jagged and crazy colors and like much more like, wow, really grabbing your attention. But there's something so comforting about whenever you pick up a Kurt Swan Superman issue.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like Kurt Swan Superman is what gives you Christopher Reeve Superman, which again gives you that comfortable feeling of this person will save you.
Well, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, hit me with another one.
All right. So I'm going to keep it with the creative department. These two guys, I feel like were each other's equivalents in the aughts. And they kind of ran, or the creatively were the guys. So
okay.
Brian Michael Bendis or Geoff Johns?
Hmm. Huh. Are we specifically talking about the aughts or like, you know, where are we drawing the line here?
Okay, let's do them on their come up. So let's say like from when Johns is doing JSA and The Flash into Green Lantern, Hawkman, like that. From before, let's go before Flashpoint.
Okay, so I'm gonna go with Geoff Johns then. Okay. I was a huge fan of Bendis back in the day. Still like his work. He was obviously extremely influential. It's hard not to see his fingerprints all over Marvel of the aughts. Extremely important. But I would have to say that if I looked at a list of their different books, if I was to go back and read one now, it's most likely going to be a Geoff Johns book. I think his stuff reads better. Not that it reads better, but I think he was not writing for the trade in the same way. And I feel like it's very evident in some of the books that it feels like I get a little bit more. And I feel like sometimes with Bendis, I'm going to get like one story over like 12 issues and which seems to get worse and worse at some points. And that to me is not as engaging and not something I want to go back and read. Whereas like, I can't tell you how many times I've read Green Lantern Rebirth or, or parts of Justice Society, like, or his run in the Flash, like, from, like, his entire Flash run is great, but when you have Blitz and you have that amazing introduction of Zoom, and then you also have, you know, Rogue War, which felt like every issue, how can I top myself and make it bigger and crazier? And, like, that, those are some of my favorite comics, like, ever. Like, I love his Flash so much that as much as I love Bendis's work, I don't know if I could, like, kind of look at one comic from Bendis in that period and say, that's the one, that's the comfort book. I'm gonna, you know, bring that around with me and read it every day for a year. Like, I just don't think I have anything of that from Bendis, whereas from Johns, I think I do.
Yeah, I almost agree with you 100% in the way that you explained it, because I love that
you said, I almost agree with you 100%.
No, because I don't think I could put it better than how you put it. Because I think anyone who knows me and would look at my shelf of DC comics, I would say it's more than 50% Geoff Johns. So for me to make an argument that I would say, oh, Brian Michael Bendis, it would be like, people would be like, you're lying, because we all know that you love Geoff Johns. But I'm in fairness, I'm looking at, you know, he's doing JSA and rebuilding a team that people, I don't think was on anybody's radar. And then Bendis is doing the Avengers at that time, which is, you know, leading the pack of team books. It became like the flagship book. And then he was doing Daredevil. His Daredevil run is second maybe to Frank Miller. And then, of course,
I forgot his Daredevil shit.
Right? Like, I'm looking at what I have of Bendis retroactively looking at it, and Alias and Ultimate Spider-Man and all those things. And I'm like, man, he had a great decade. Like, side by side, these guys are going back to back with, I guess, if he's got the Flash, he's got Spider-Man. If he's got the team, he's got a team. If he's got his character where he's kind of redefining him or breathing life back into a character that people, you know, they're both kind of doing that. But for me, what I still love about DC is what Geoff Johns, the way he wrote those characters, was a guy who really, really loved these characters so much. And I feel that when I read them. Not to take anything away from what Bendis did. At all.
Like, okay, so I love Daredevil by Bendis, so I did forget about that for a moment. It's not going to change my mind, though, but, like, I also forgot for a moment that, like, Geoff Johns also, you know, really brought back and made people excited about Teen Titans again.
Yes,
you
know? Yes,
like,
yes, that's...
And that run is awesome, and, again, man. I mean, well, I won't say the run is awesome. The first 2 years is fantastic. And, like, the lead-up, everything leading up to Infinite Crisis always felt so exciting. He was obviously part of the Brain Trust that did Countdown to Infinite Crisis, which is the best and saddest Blue Beetle story of all time, I think, because they finally get Blue Beetle respect, and then he gets his head blown up. But, like, there's just – and, like, again, I can go back and read Green Lantern Rebirth, and you get to that page when – the ring goes back on Hal, and you have him, like, the feel, the way that Johns describes the feeling of that moment and what it feels like, and having so much damn will and having him go and confront Sinestro. Like, when you get to that moment, you're like, holy fuck yes, like, I want this to happen. And you know, what he also did, which was, I mean, maybe lessened in future issues that happen afterwards, but at least in that first series, he made sure that Hal respected Kyle Rayner, and that they weren't just bringing back Hal and going to throw Kyle Rayner to the side, although they kind of did later. But they, you know, they bring him back, and they have this great moment of them shaking hands, and he's basically saying, like, you kept it going, you kept the light burning when no one else could, and that gives him respect. And again, it was a nice way of kind of meta commentary saying that, you know, there was a lot of people who couldn't wait for Hal to come back and didn't want Kyle Rayner, but they're saying, you know what, just because Hal's back, where Kyle has a place, Kyle belongs to the table too. And again, the masterful writing by Geoff Johns to make sure that you felt that.
Yeah. I think, man, it's just, it's so hard to really say which guy had a bigger impact. I just think that when you take a character like Green Lantern, who has been off the table, the Hal Jordan version, you bring him back and put him in a space where they want to make a movie off of this character, albeit it sucked, but strictly based off of the success of the comic, they want to make a movie out of it. I think you've done your job.
For sure. That was a good one. Yeah, that was a tough one.
That was tough. That was tough for me too.
Man, putting me in the hot seat, having to choose between, like, my favorite children. Yeah. let's see. Okay. Which one for you is just your favorite. I'm not going to make it about historical importance or whatever, but if you had to choose, you can only watch one, and the other one has to be thrown away forever, X-Men the Animated Series or Batman the Animated Series?
I got to go Batman the Animated Series. Just because I watched them all. I wanted to love the X-Men the Animated Series growing up, but I realized I don't know how important all this stuff is, and I feel like I'm out of the loop. Whereas Batman, I felt like any episode, I could watch it and appreciate how good it was for just a single episode.
Interesting.
And it's still the storytelling, the writing, the character design of the animated series of Batman, the animated series, for some reason has a timelessness, even though it has that Art Deco kind of thing, but somewhat futuristic at the same time. I don't know what it is that they just made it work. I wished Batman, the animated series was drawn like X-Men, because those look more like toys I wanted to play with. But now watching it, I'm like, it's that comfort food. At the same time, there's a sophistication to it, which I really appreciate now. How about you?
I think it's X-Men. I mean, I love both when they came out, and I own X-Men on DVD. I own Batman on Blu-ray, but there's just something about, like, the X-Men voice acting to me is so perfect, and I'm not to take anything away from Batman, but for me, if I'm just going to put something on, it's going to be X-Men. And when I hear the words, you know, previously on X-Men, I just feel a shiver go down my spine. Like, this is accessing that primal kid inside.
Yeah, and I that's the thing that I really respect about what the Marvel animated series did. Like, watching Spider-Man during that era, I'd probably pick that over everything, just because I remember running home to not miss the next episode in that soap opera, because I'm like, this actually continues. They're referencing things that happened 5 episodes ago. I've never watched a cartoon that does this. I know X-Men did, but I kind of missed the boat on it a bit, where I'm like, it's going to be too much for me to catch up and know what's going on. But with Spider-Man, I always felt somewhat at home, like I can get into that zone a bit better. And once I did, I'm like, this is incredible that they're doing this. I people would call me after school and I'd be like, I can't talk. I got to watch this. This is important stuff. Seriously, I love that show.
I remember watching it on Fox Kids on Saturdays for the new episodes of It and X-Men. And that was like a huge thing. Like, I remember, I'm trying to remember what year it was. I think this first year I went to this camp, and at this camp I was going to be like a counselor in training. So I think I was like, I want to say 12. It had to have been like maybe 95, 96. And I remember in the training for it, I don't know, it was 96. I was like so obsessed with the Spider-Man animated series. I knew like every chapter of every season. Like, I could tell you what happened in that chapter. And I remember talking about it with like the other people there, and they're like, holy shit, you really like Spider-Man. I'm like, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, you would have been able to tell me how everything finished, because I never ended up finishing the series.
Oh my God, that makes me so sad.
Yeah, because I kept wanting to watch that. Every time it would get to the point of that next episode, they would restart the series to the beginning. I'm like, can you finish this thing already? I was always at the point of Madame Web, I think after like Mary Jane, after he had proposed to her. And they never were showing episodes past that. So I never ended up seeing the Secret War.
And sorry, the clones and all that. To this date you haven't seen it?
To this date, even when it came back on Netflix, I tried to watch it and I just couldn't sit through it anymore. I'm like, maybe I'll just leave it where I finished
oh,
it.
Oh no, I'm so sad for you.
And I'm waiting for them to put it out on DVD, because I will buy it. Hopefully one day they do that.
It's not coming. They're not going to do it. However, it is coming to Disney Plus.
Oh, okay. There you go. I'll watch it there.
So in a couple weeks, you can watch it. You have no excuse. I'll be quizzing you. I'll be texting you every day being like, what episode are you on now?
I've seen, I think, the very like last episode. So I have it spoiled. But I haven't. I remember him setting up his team for the Secret Wars and who he picked to be there with him. But I never watched the whole last chapter of it.
Oh my God. Did you see the Scarlet Spider?
Yes, I did. I did see the Scarlet Spider.
All right, good. Well, you're forgiven a little bit. Even my son has seen all that, okay? All
right. Yeah, your son's already read Crisis on Infinite Earths, whatever. Zach's the coolest.
Zach knows a lot of comic book stuff, and like, I mean, obviously it's my fault, but every time he says something, I'm like, oh, I'm so proud of this.
Well, that's the least you could do. If you're going to be a good dad, you got to teach him all of this stuff. If you didn't, I'd be like, what are you doing?
So yesterday we started, I grabbed three comics for him to choose from. One was Fantastic Four Heroes Return, Volume 1. I don't know why I grabbed this. I grabbed Spider-Man Big Time, Volume 1, and I grabbed the back from the original trades, the first trade for the Mark Waid and Mike Waringo version of Fantastic Four called, I believe, Imaginauts. And he picked the Fantastic Four, which I was actually really surprised about. I thought for sure he'd pick Big Time. I did not think he would take Heroes Return, so I was pretty safe there. So he picked the Mark Waid and Mike Waringo stuff, and so we read like the first issue, and I'm like, God damn, this comic gets me. Like, I love this whole comic. Like, the Mike Waringo art is great. There's some good humor in it. The end of the issue, like, this was, I think, originally a 9-cent issue. I remember I had like 40 copies thinking, I'm going to go to university and give these away to people, make them read comics. It failed miserably. But at least I had the belief that I wanted to share things. But yeah, no, it's a beautiful issue. Have you ever read Mark Waid and Mike Waringo's Fantastic Four?
Yes, I did. That was actually one of the questions I had on here for you.
Oh, well, let's skip to the question then.
FF by Waid and Waringo or Hickman?
That's so hard. I gotta go Mark Waid because I think at the end of the day, I think his was more about family than Hickman's was. Family still mattered, but it was also about the big epic sprawling story and all these kind of pieces eventually coming together to create this massive ending so that when it happened, your breath was taken away. Whereas when Mark Waid's run wrapped, I felt an emotional lift. I felt like it meant something. I felt like these characters make this choice to be together and to be a family no matter what. And they don't take the easy way out no matter what. And so from an emotional standpoint, I think Mark Waid hit on what makes the Fantastic Four really so special. They are a family. And so from that very first issue where you have the whole idea that Reed Richards makes them superheroes, makes them celebrities as a way of atoning for the fact that he was stupid, that he, you know, he was the reason why his friends were turned into almost monsters, and that the only way he could make it up to them was to make them heroes, to make them celebrities, to try and make amends for this stupid thing he'd done in his life, which was like so brilliant and smart. And the emotional intelligence of Mark Waid to write that just took my breath away. And even reading it yesterday with my son, it still meant something so much to me. And yet at the end of that arc as well, you have Ben making the ultimate choice that, no, I'm not going to let Reed Richards take away, you know, the thing powers, because that's depriving the world of Reed Richards. That's depriving the world of a man who, with his intellect and his, you know, being able to do things with his hands, can do so many amazing things to the world. I'm okay with being the way I am. This is more important to the world and to my family. So absolutely Mark Waid. I love Jonathan Hickman, but I, from an emotional level, I just don't think it's near as perfect as Mark Waid.
Yeah. And I think, too, when I look at those two books and what I think of them, one is feels like a little bit more of a joy to read, where the other one can feel like there's going to be some work involved. It will pay off. This will be worth it. But it is a bit of a chore. Not in a bad way. I don't want that to sound like a pejorative. But when I think of the way Mark Waid and Waringo present those characters, there's a lot of fun to it. Even in those dark moments, you've got those familial, like you said, those emotional beats that's what carries those stories.
As I would say Hickman's might be more exciting. Because, yes. Again, especially as you hit the freight train and all the momentum starts building up and you're like, oh, my God, this is happening. This is really going to happen. Like, this big thing is finally going to pay off. Whereas, not to take anything away from Mark Waid's, but it's shorter stories. Some of them are so thrilling. Like, Authoritative Action is so fantastic as you have Reed, like, basically deciding that he's going to make it look like he's blown up and that he's gone just so he can, you know, entrap Dr. Doom forever and that they will always be, you know, at each other. But this is the only way to keep Dr. Doom off the board forever. Like it's thrilling stuff. You read through that and you're like, you can feel the adrenaline pumping. But does that go through the entire, you know, run? No, not in a bad way. Whereas Hickman's, I feel like it just gets crazier and bigger and stronger and more exciting. And when you get to the end, you're like, holy fuck.
Yeah. And a lot of what he establishes there carries on into the next thing that he takes on, which ultimately culminates. Like, I feel the real ending to his FF run is Secret Wars.
Yeah, which at the beginning I would never have thought that. And then you get to the end of Secret Wars and you're like, they were telling a Reed Richards story the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. Which that's why I feel like it's going to take you a little bit of work, but when you get there, it's going to be worth it. Whereas the Mark Waid Fantastic Four is a here, read this. It's going to be, it'll be easy to get into this and to get out of it, and you're going to feel very satisfied when it's all said and done.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you want to put a pin in it there? And we could continue this another time.
Let's put the pin in it. I think we've covered a lot of crazy topics.
Yes, we have. We got it. Now you can think of some other ones to challenge me when we do it for the next round.
All right, we'll do.
Sounds good. So, what's coming up next for Comic Shenanigans? Tell the people listening.
Well, I'm hoping it happens, but at the moment, November is supposed to be the month where I have a chance to finally sit down and talk to Marv Wolfman. Of course, the writer of Crisis and Infinite Earths, amongst so many other titles, the new Teen Titans. He wrote Amazing Spider-Man. Like, he's done so much. So hopefully I'll be talking with Marv. And then I'm also hoping we're supposed to have a conversation where I'm going to talk with both Mark Waid and Brian Augustin to talk about writing two different Archie series, Archie 1941 and Archie 1955, which is their current work together. And I'm also supposed to have a conversation with Ben Rabb, who wrote a bunch of books back in the 90s. And he's kind of disappeared, but he's also writing TV now. So that should be exciting. So at the moment, those are three upcoming episodes in the month of November. And then we recently had a conversation with Kelly Thompson, which I really enjoyed, talking about her work at Marvel right now. I just had an episode go up, I believe, this morning, where you and I chatted for a long time about upcoming Marvel books that are coming out January to April next year. Those are trades. So some good stuff. And I'm actually supposed to be – I just recorded an appearance. Finally, it finally happened. I'm going to be on the Amazing Spider Talk podcast. Technically, what? Only one of their Patreon episodes, but at some point, I think he's going to release it in the regular feed. And I joked on the episode that I've been waiting for years for the call. And actually, he had put out on Twitter, you know, does anyone want to talk about Absolute Carnage with me? And I'm like, me, 1,000 times me. I've been waiting for years. You've been on my show every 100 episodes. Please, for the love of God. And he's like, of course. Come on. I'm like, yes, this is great.
Congratulations, because I know how important it is for you to have gotten a chance to be on that show. And they don't just let anybody get on that show. I know that.
Well, it's funny. They don't. But recently, they've had like a lot of like co-hosts on these Patreon episodes about Absolute Carnage. And I'm like, man, where did my email get lost? Like, what is happening? So I was waiting for the spider phone to finally blink. And finally, it did.
Congratulations. When that episode does get posted, I'll definitely check out Adam Chapman's first appearance on the Amazing Spider Talk. What?
It's going to be a long time because, again, I don't know when he's going to put those episodes on his main feed because that's on the Patreon. But, I love having conversations with Dan, so it was a lot of fun to be on his own show.
You made it, Adam. You made it.
Right? I feel like I finally made it. I can retire. I'm not going to, but I could.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the Cave of Solitude. I always have a great time when we have these chats. And looking forward to part two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope next time that my voice will be in better shape. I realized as we were talking, I'm like, oh my God, I sound just as hoarse as I feel.
No, you sound fine. I couldn't even tell. We got the sexy Chapman for this episode.
Oh my goodness.
All right, Adam, thank you for being on the show. We will chat soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.